Morning, Your Honors.
Morning.
May it please the court. I want to make it clear, first of all, that we are not asking this court to mediate any scientific dispute. This appeal is about two significant Administrative Procedure Act violations. One, a rulemaking violation, and second, an adjudicative violation. Now, with respect to the first, the administrative law judge in this case took a preamble to regulations, which you're well familiar with because this preamble issue has been before this court before, and announced first that he was going to consult it, which courts have said he may do, and then he announced when he wrote his decision. Well, first of all, after he announced he was going to consult it, we did discovery on the preamble with an intention of proving that the principles in the preamble were bad science, old science, and not valid. And they were going to, and the administrative law judge went on, made his decision. There was a lot of medical evidence presented in this case. And then the administrative law judge, in his opinion, said that he had applied the preamble and he was going to shift the burden of proof, change the standard.
Did he decide that the preamble was binding? Did he say the preamble?
Well, I don't know how you could say he didn't decide it wasn't binding.
It's easy. He didn't call it binding.
Well, let me say this, he says, I have relied on the preamble and the revised 2000 regulations. This is on Appendix 410. It's in his opinion. I advise the parties that the court may look to the preamble, and then he goes on to say that he has looked to it and he has resolved issues of credibility upon it. Now, you know, the thing is that
But what's wrong with finding it persuasive? I think that's what you're upset about, that he found it persuasive.
Well, he found it persuasive, but the other problem...
But what's wrong? Just help me with that. Why? That's not bad by itself, is it?
Well...
A judge can find a brief persuasive.
He treated the preamble as a rule. He was trained to treat it as a rule. He did, in his opinion, treat it as a rule. And if he treated it as a rule, and there are tests.
What if he treated it as an... I'm trying to figure out what you would agree is okay. So you have your three experts. What if he said it was a dispute of scientific fact between three experts and the DOL preamble? And the administrative law judge essentially treated the DOL preamble as an expert opinion. And then it was just a battle of experts.
Right. He did. I would say that's a correct statement.
Then what's wrong? What's wrong? Then it's just a credibility dispute.
But if the preamble is going to serve as an expert witness, is going to serve as a determiner of how the burden of proof is allocated in these cases, then it's a rule. I mean, the APA...
It's not a rule. It's just any more than just scientific facts in your expert's opinions are a rule. If he actually said, I find your experts more persuasive.
But that's not what he said. Our experts testified about the issues that were raised by the preamble. The claimant's experts did not. They didn't even mention it. They didn't mention anything that was in the preamble. Our expert testified. They gave evidence. They cited voluminous authority, and our experts came to the conclusion that in this particular case, the preamble essentially was not an accurate scientific statement of the facts that were relevant to a determination.
And you're saying disagreeing with that means he found the preamble binding?
Well, the preamble doesn't assert facts. What the preamble does, it asserts rules. It has rules, not facts. And then what he did...
Well, it has like your five examples. It has the ratio changes. Your experts say the ratio changes between FEV.
Let me address it right.
Well, let me finish. Your experts say that the ratio changes can only be caused by smoking. And the preamble says, well, our scientific studies suggest that it can also be caused by coal mining. And he essentially said, I'm relying on the preamble's expert or the preamble's statement of scientific fact, over your experts. That strikes me as just a credibility dispute. It's not saying that the preamble is binding.
I think there's a couple of things. First of all, there are tests for determining whether the something is a rule or something is a guideline. And the test essentially is it treated as binding, and clearly it was. There's no contrary evidence coming into this record that addresses that FEV1 ratio. And I will tell you something else about that. There is no science that supports it. Absolutely none. All of the science goes the other way.
Well, you would agree that we have a published opinion that already rejects the argument that the science in the preamble on this point. Central States essentially upheld a credibility determination.
That's right. And we have attempted in this case to challenge that principle because it is unsupported by science. And the interesting thing, it's unsupported by any science. All of the science goes the other way. Even the publications of NIOSH cite the literature that our doctors have cited in addressing this question. And so what we're confronted with,
you're pushing this point so strongly, why isn't it just a substantial evidence case? And you're saying there's not substantial evidence.
It's a rule case.
Okay, well, just stick with me for a second. You're the one saying there's nothing. Why don't you just win on substantial evidence grounds? In other words, there's not substantial evidence.
The argument, I think, touches upon a substantial evidence concern. And the second part of my argument is that the administrative law judge didn't consider the record. He only considered the preamble. And he illegally, his preamble was contrary to the regulations and the statute because it shifted the burden of proof to the employer on questions where the statute retains the burden of proof for the claimant. And that, it seems to me, is about as clear-cut a case as a rule as you're going to find. The burden of proof.
I don't understand the argument. Just because you find the scientific statements in the preamble persuasive, that means you've shifted the burden of proof?
He said he did. He shifted the burden of proof. We are not required in this case to establish disability causation. And he shifted the burden to us on disability causation. He said so. He said he is judging the credibility of the evidence.
I thought we were just on whether legal pneumoconiosis was established, right? So is that maybe I'm getting...
Well, no, that's a different question. This was on disability causation. Whether legal pneumoconiosis was established brings up other parts of the preamble that we also contested. I mean, the thing is that nobody pays any attention to the science. They pay attention only to the preamble. And I think it's very important in terms of looking at whether this is a rule. This is the document that trains ALJs. We've lodged it with the court. It says consistency with the preamble. It directs the ALJs on various pages. It says discredit the physicians who state... so forth. This is by a staff attorney at the Labor Department who wrote this for the ALJs. This is how the ALJs were trained. And they say this ALJ came on later. Well, I don't know. It was out there. This thing is available. It's a public document.
There's a lot of FJC training of federal judges, some of which people don't all agree with. And this happens
all
the time.
Well, it tells you how to...
training. It's still up to the judge in a case to decide what...
Yeah, but the judge wasn't paying any attention to the training that he may be able to evaluate the evidence based upon its relative merits. He was doing exactly what he was instructed to do by this document. You must do this. And in the question of the FEV1 issue, I mean, I don't know what more you could do to challenge it. You said in Central Ohio, okay, challenge it. We did. We have tons of evidence in this case challenging it. There is no evidence on the other side, only the preamble.
So are you raising a substantial evidence challenge? It wasn't clear to me. The red brief suggests.
No, I'm raising an APA challenge. These are APA issues.
Okay, so.
Is it a rule? If it was a rule, it was not
published. There is no substantial evidence challenge.
Well, the second part of the case is that it's a decision-making error under the Administrative Procedure Act.
So your argument is that the ALJ committed legal error because the ALJ found the preamble binding.
Right.
And it's not a scientific dispute about whether there is sufficient evidence in the record.
He didn't consider it. Evidence was presented to him, as you pointed out in the Central Ohio Coal case, that we had to present evidence. So we presented evidence, tons of it, and a big, long explanation. And our expert even addressed the decision in Central Ohio Coal. He mentioned it by name in his opinion. The opinions are quite long. They're quite detailed. They address all of the modern science. And in that particular instance, he said that the science doesn't support it. I'm
still not understanding the answer to Judge Murphy's question. I know you have an APA challenge that the ALJ treated the preamble as binding. So I got that. So just, is that it in the case?
I understand.
Is that it in the case, or is there a second thing you're asking?
I understand that the connection between my APA challenge and substantial evidence, because a lot of the cases get into that.
Okay, you understand it. We don't understand what you're saying. Help us. What are you trying to do? Is there a second part of the case or not?
Well, there is a second part of the case, and the second part of the case is that the administrative law judge did not consider the evidence that was presented to him on its merits, which he is required to do.
Because he treated it,
it was all preamble
as binding.
The preamble was binding.
So that's really the same first argument.
It's
proving it's not harmless, I guess is the way you would say it. You'd say,
I guess so.
What made this harmful is he not only treated it this way, but then look what he did. He ignored everything because he thought it was binding.
And as far as the test...
But that's the one issue in the case then. That's a single issue.
Well, it's broken down into two parts then, I suppose. I mean, the Supreme Court in the Pauley versus Beth Energy Mines case held, I don't know if it's a holding, it's close to a holding, said that when the Department of Labor writes these black lung regulations, they are required to keep this, to apply in those regulations the best, most modern science. And that's something the Labor Department doesn't want to do. It's got these 20-year-old guidelines, which are mostly all untrue. The thing is, another point that we didn't make a big deal out of it, but latency, which we did raise, and which our experts raised, that there is not one single scientific study, research study, that establishes that legal pneumoconiosis, which is basically smoking, has a latent potential for latent onset. I mean, the science isn't here to support the preamble, and the preamble is all this ALJ used. He was trained to use it. The Benefits Review Board would reverse him if he didn't. And that what's the case? The Shipley case in the Fourth Circuit is a good example of that, where the ALJ didn't use the preamble, and then the board sent it back, and he didn't use it again. They sent it back and said, use the preamble. And so he used the preamble, and then he awarded benefits. And I think, you know, Judge Quattlebaum had a very insightful dissent on that issue. And we're not getting a fair day in court, is what my point is.
Okay, that's helpful. Thank you so much. You'll get your rebuttal. Morning.
Good morning. Chief Judge Sutton, and may it please the court. I'm William Bush for the Director of the Office of Workers' Compensation Programs at the United States Department of Labor. I'm here to address the single issue that the Director briefed in this case, which is the Wilgar Lands challenge to the protective order that the ALJ issued precluding discovery into the 2000 preamble. The employer forfeited that challenge in at least two ways. The board held that they forfeited it before that body, and they've failed to challenge that forfeiture finding before this court.
I was curious. Are you concerned? Like, I read their brief, and then I read your brief, and I was like, why is this brief here? Because their brief did not seem to challenge the discovery order. I guess, are you worried about the first argument that maybe it's an implied challenge or something? Or
I don't think so, Your Honor. I agree with you that the employer's opening brief in this case does not present a very square challenge to that discovery order. They do, however, in their requested remedy, make some very specific references to remand with granting of the protective order, or that's the one really that really squarely involves that. And that's since we asked for that protective order in the first place, we felt that we were obligated to.
Are you uncomfortable talking about the bindingness of the preamble, or I don't want to stress you out?
Well, we haven't taken a position in that on that in this case specifically. We've previously taken a position in Central
Ohio. I was just trying to figure out what the last point he made got my attention, that if an ALJ didn't respect the preamble, the ALJ doesn't deal with it. He was making, he seemed to be suggesting it'd be basically automatic reversal. And the more that's true, the more, I don't know, if you don't call it binding, it sure seems like it is. I wondered if you had an answer to that point.
It's never been the director's position that the preamble is binding.
How about, will you get reversed if you don't consider it as an ALJ?
The director wouldn't ask for that as a litigant.
Mm-hmm. You can ignore it. You can just decide, I don't think it's very persuasive, and I found the other briefs in the case more persuasive, the other experts more persuasive, and that doesn't lead to presumptive wrongness at the next level of review.
Not in the director's view, Your Honor.
What did you think of my analogy to just treating it as an extra kind of quasi-expert report, because it has a lot of statements backed by the scientific studies that are that were in existence when they issued the preamble in 2000. And so the ALJ can consider it for what it's worth and treat it as persuasive to the extent that the ALJ finds the statements that are made persuasive and it's kind of supported by the scientific studies that are cited in the preamble.
The director views the preamble merely as an explanation for the rule changes that occurred in 2000. And to the extent, you know, that it does that by explaining what the director thinks the scientific articles it discusses mean, but those are all very general statements about the nature of particular disease processes and how they relate to coal mine dust exposure. They're not statements about specific claimants, and they're not or the diseases that those claimants have. So I think that's the distinction I would draw there. I would be, you know, we've never been faced with an issue of considering it that way, but it's not an expert witness by itself.
All right, thank you. Appreciate you being here. Thanks for answering the questions you were not asked to answer.
You're very welcome.
Morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Evan Smith. I'm here from Apple Red Legal Aid in the mountains of Eastern Kentucky on behalf of Linda Adams to defend her award and her deceased husband's award of federal black lung benefits. So in the limited time I have here, I can't fully explain the danger that this petition presents to the black lung benefit system. The petitioner here, Old Republic, seeks to use this case as a vehicle to upend decades of settled precedent in black lung benefits law that parties have privately relied on, ordered their affairs, and the agency has really based much of the system upon. So there are three big...
Well, how do you respond to the point he was making towards the end, your friend on the other side, that, hey, if the ALJ doesn't respect this, invoke it, refer to it, gets presumptively reversed? Is that just not your experience, or how do you look at that?
Yeah, so I'm not aware of, you know, any rule that the Benefits Review Board has that would require an ALJ's decision to be reversed or vacated if they didn't follow the preamble. If an ALJ were to look at the medical evidence and say, you know, I find this more persuasive than what the preamble statements are,
that's the ALJ's. Do you know the case where Judge Quattlebaum dissented? Is that ringing a bell he was referring?
I recall that case when it came down from the Fourth Circuit previously, but again, I just point out that obviously Judge Quattlebaum was in dissent there. You know, that wasn't the rule in that case. Mm-hmm. And I think the...
Well, would you agree that it would be concerning? So there's two ways it could be binding. You could expressly say, I find it binding, and then you could just find it binding in every case and just not say that.
Right.
And so what evidence, and they say that's in effect what the ALJ has been doing. What evidence do you think shows that, at least in this case, that the ALJ did not treat the preamble as binding? Other than, I mean, there's no express statements as far as I can tell, but the idea is it was impliedly treated as such.
Yeah, a few thoughts in relation to that. I mean, first off, again, the ALJ repeatedly made statements saying they're not binding. In fact, the ALJ even went so far as to explain in a footnote that a Tenth Circuit opinion that went a little broad in saying that ALJs need to follow the preamble, ALJ went out of his way to say, that's wrong. I'm not bound to follow the preamble. So the ALJ statements alone, again, we generally take parties, especially judges, at their word. And so in this case, that's the case. The second thing is that, again, I think as this court knows, especially in the sentencing context, often judges don't mind to say, you know, this isn't the way that I would rule, but I'm bound by some type of precedent of this court or by the sentencing guidelines or otherwise, and so I'm required to do this. You know, we have a hearing transcript here. The judge is, you know, just talking from the bench. There's no statement in any of this that the judge was having an outcome other than what he as the finder of fact would be inclined to do. And so, again, in the absence of such statements, I don't think there's anything here to think that it was treated as binding. And what happened here, again, is very similar to the 14 cases where this court has affirmed ALJ's use of the preamble and said that without some indication that it's binding here, you know, there's no reason to think that's what the ALJ in this case did. And again, if we want to contrast this with Allentown Mack, you know, which the petitioner here relies on heavily, in that case, you had academic literature, you had dissenting Supreme Court justices, you had really a whole body of people that were saying that what the NLRB is actually doing is different than what they're saying. And there's just nothing comparable in the black lung benefit system here.
Why do you think it's appropriate to cite the preamble at all? I know we have, obviously, the precedent binding us, but just as a theoretical matter, it seems to be relying on statements that are quasi-expert statements that are used to discredit the other side's expert opinions. So if an expert came in and made the statements that was in the preamble, that would seem perfectly appropriate, then it is just a battle of experts. No, you know, for the one example I gave, coal dust can cause the ratio change, not just cigarette smoking. But why do you think it's okay to rely on the preamble statement to make that credibility determination that the expert's not credible?
I mean, I think fundamentally the preamble is not that different than medical treatises that would be down in this court's library. You know, an adjudicator is allowed to look at publicly available information and use that as some sense to determine, you know, what is metric that we can use to try to make sense of the statements that are being made in this individual case. And again, the judge made clear beforehand that he was going to do so, and the petitioner here had the opportunity with their experts to say why they disagreed with it. In fact, Dr. Rosenberg did so quite explicitly. He also disagreed with this court's binding precedent, saying that this court has gotten it wrong as well. And again, if there were to be some scientific developments in the future that really did show these are wrong, there is room to do that. But the important thing is that the ALJ did not find what Dr. Rosenberg had to say here persuasive. And I have to say, that's not surprising. There haven't been any studies that compare coal miners to the general population and give the type of actual objective scientific evidence that Dr. Rosenberg's theories are on. So, again, it's not shocking that this court and ALJs have not found his theories to be persuasive.
Can I ask a more specific question now? I guess it's about the rejection of, I don't know how to pronounce the one expert's name. Dr. Tutior. So he had a bunch of general statistics that suggest this type of COPD would be very rare from coal dust, and then the ALJ's finding of that analysis not credible was that it was not tailored to Mr. Adams. But this goes back to what kind of in their brief they cite this just Judge Easterbrook opinion where he suggests that the best types of studies and scientific questions are generalized statistical studies. It seems somewhat strange to me to say that if a general statistical study says this will happen from coal dust and 1 in 1,000 times, that's pretty good evidence that it didn't happen in this specific case because it's rare. And as far as I can tell, the ALJ's response to that, well, it was just general statistics and it doesn't highlight this individual circumstance. It kind of does, though, right? I mean, if you say something is 1 in 1,000 to happen, it's less likely to have happened in this case, even if you don't know anything about this particular person. So I wonder if you could like maybe respond to that analysis for why general statistics actually might be better evidence of causation? Or
The first thing I'd say is that the rate of obstructive lung impairance in coal miners is far higher than 1 in 1,000.
Yeah.
I mean, we're in, you know, somewhere between, you know, 1% and 10%. Again, it's single digit percent, and yes, the rate is higher in smokers. But then, as the ALJ explained here, the real question is that in a smoking coal miner like Mr. Adams, would the coal mine dust have had some additive effect in here? And to that, the medical literature is quite clear that coal mine dust causes obstructive lung disease, cigarette smoke causes obstructive lung disease, and smoking coal miners have a doubly increased rate. And then when we look specifically at Mr. Adams's own exposure, he worked in very dusty conditions in some small coal mines in eastern Kentucky where the rates of coal dust exposure were often higher than in the mining industry as a whole. Again, I think that there is very good reason to say that when we look at the facts of this individual case, that there are reasons not to just totally discount it, even if the rates of smoking are generally higher. And again, this also connects with the causation standards set by this court. We don't have to show that most of Mr. Adams's lung problems were caused by coal mine dust. We just have to show that it was caused by more than a de minimis part. And again, and what this court has said, or generally, again, in Archon the Green versus Groves is the principal case on this from this court, is that in that case, even when the doctor said that the effect of coal mine dust was actual, the word was minimally, that was found to be sufficient to prove legal pneumoconiosis. So when you've got a low standard and when you've got scientific evidence that shows that there is a significant number of smoking coal miners that get obstructive impairments and have some contribution from coal mine dust, then it's justified to do it in this case, even if, generally speaking, as a matter of statistics, coal miners do get obstructive lung impairments more frequently than non-smoking coal miners. Does that answer your question, Judge? I mean, the other thing that I just want to take a minute to point out as well is that from Mrs. Adams' perspective, this case never should have been remanded to Judge Golden in the first place. That, you know, when the prior ALJ issued an award of benefits with the same onset date that was here, this case, the employer raised an appointments clause challenge for the first time before the Benefits Review Board, and there shouldn't have even been a remand in the first place. So the only other thing that I would just add is that if for any other reason, as you know, more deeply review the ALJ's decision, if there's any pause, I think we also need to go back and consider the prior award. And I'll just say that, the fact that two separate ALJs independently found similar opinions to be credible and also discredited the employer's experts just shows that this isn't some aberrant decision by some rogue ALJ, two reasonable decision makers reached the same conclusion here.
Thank you, Mr. Smith.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Solomons, you have 2 minutes.
Just a few points. First of all, this court has no jurisdiction over prior decisions that were vacated and not appealed. And also, there were two decisions of an ALJ that denied benefits in this case. So that's neither here nor there. Also, a lot of the, you know, I try to stay away from the science, but a lot of the science that Mr. Smith is talking about is a bunch of fairy tales, I think. That's not established in the medical literature. And you know, just the administrative law judge's treatment of Dr. Tudor, reliance on statistics, that's how scientists or doctors make differential diagnosis. If he didn't rely on statistics, that would be a basis for finding it wasn't supported by substantial evidence or for rejecting the opinion. That's what scientists do. They use data and they make decisions based on data. So I don't see that. That's really an issue. The protective order, the Department of Labor says that it's not taking a position on the preamble. But the problem is that the administrative law judges and the benefits review boards always take a position on the preamble. And in this case, in connection with this Judge Golden, we went back about a year and a half. Every single solitary case he had that didn't go off on some other basis was decided on the basis of the preamble. There were 10 cases. In our case, he cited it 11 times as the basis for his decision making. Now, he could say he wasn't bound by it, but anybody looking at it would reach the inevitable conclusion that he thought he was bound by it.
Or that he found it persuasive and he's consistent.
Well, he was consistently bound by it at every point.
No, if you find it persuasive, why would you not treat it the same?
If he found it persuasive, then his opinion would not be supported by substantial evidence because he didn't consider anything else. He didn't consider the evidence that was...
I didn't realize that was part of the problem, but...
That's what he did. That's the decision, the adjudicative problem. He didn't consider it. He rejected it out of hand. Didn't read it, never looked at it.
Okay, I see your time's up. Thanks to both of you for your helpful briefs and arguments. We appreciate all three of you in that respect, and the case will be submitted, and the clerk may call the last case.